Welcome to a new episode of Africa with André, where we celebrate Africa one story at a time.
Big Five, we want to see the Big Five. This is a sentence that safari guides hear a lot. And it makes sense. First-time visitors to Africa that are going on safari mostly do want to see these animals. And I'll be honest, I love a good lion sighting, and seeing a leopard in a tree is something special. But a game drive or a game walk is about so much more than just these two cats and three large grey animals. The smaller animals, the insects, the birds, the plants, and in particular how many of them rely on each other or have some kind of symbiotic relationship is really amazing. We're going to chat about this with Grant Reed from Letaka Safaris in Botswana. He started this mobile tented safari company in the year 2000 together with his brother. And he has a guiding academy in Botswana, so he has spent many years guiding guests on various safaris in Southern Africa. Hi, Grant, and welcome to the podcast.
Hey, André, thank you very much for having me.
Tell us about yourself. How did you get into guiding, and what were you doing before you started Letaka?
Oh, we're going back a long way now, André. I guess my introduction to guiding was when I was 5 years old. My father was a weekend naturalist. My grandfather was a fantastic amateur naturalist, who had many achievements under his belt in terms of bird ringing or bird banding, as some countries call it. He had the first swallow recorded. It confirmed the migration from Southern Africa to Europe. So growing up, my father was very involved in the Wildlife Society and in the dendrological and birding societies, and used to lead weekend walks. So I think the first time I went on trail with my dad, I was about 5 years old. Okay. And I'd walk at the back feeling very important. And that was the entrance into guiding and the start of my passion.
Yeah, that's great. When it's brought down through generations like that, then it's really just part of your everyday life.
100%. I think it's in the DNA, and I really hope it continues with my boys.
Yeah. Let's jump straight into it. I've called this episode Not the Big Five, or It's So Much More Than Just the Big Five. What are the Big Five? Why are they called that? And why do people consider them to be the exciting animals?
Well, yeah, when you invited me onto the show, my response was I enjoy the topic of the Big Five, or the phrase of the Big Five, as much as a double tequila shot. It's it's something which has been vastly overused. And, you know, like everything, it's not all bad. It is a hook. It's something that people discuss, and it's a reason that people travel. Nobody really knows who coined the phrase. It comes from the late 19th century, when it was basically referred to the five most dangerous animals to hunt. Back then, there were no photographic safaris. Nobody came to Africa to look at the animals. You know, people were coming to shoot the animals. And gradually, the term picked up a little bit of momentum. And around about the 1980s, it started to really rear its head in terms of our industry, photographic tourism, where people were saying, I have a reserve, it's got the Big Five. And so it became this marketing thing. And, you know, everybody in the industry is looking for a unique selling point. Historically, what was considered to be the five most dangerous animals to hunt, elephant, rhino, it's blanket rhino in the Big Five. But historically, actually, the black rhino was the far more dangerous one to hunt. Yeah. Buffalo, which have got an incredible reputation for aggression and for being super dangerous when you're on foot. And then leopard and lion.
Yeah. I think the buffalo is the one animal that doesn't give you a warning if it doesn't like you. It just charges straight away.
Well, the warning is often a grunt which comes simultaneously with the charge. So.
Okay. You don't have a lot of time.
Yeah. It's like somebody giving you a warning shot straight between the eyes. And in terms of game viewing, obviously the buffalo is really the odd one out. It's really just a big, angry black cow, whereas you've got cheetah and wild dog and all these other really, you know, sort of super exciting animals to see.
Those that don't know anything about the animals initially are surprised that a giraffe or a hippo is not part of the Big Five. But I suppose that's because it doesn't make a trophy for the wall as easily as, or as beautiful as the other traditional Big Fives from the hunting days.
Absolutely. And we see it, you know, we also see it a lot. People come over, and actually super high on their list is giraffe and zebra, because these are really charismatic animals that fill all the storybooks. People have known about them since they were kids. Yeah. And, you know, we as guides are often very guilty of glossing over these animals because they're common. We can also sometimes be guilty of trying to show people what we think they want to see rather than what they would like to see.
Yeah. Which animal do you get the most excited about seeing, Grant?
I love leopard. There's nothing more rewarding as a guide than tracking a leopard, finding tracks early in the morning, thinking through where it's going, what it's doing, following the tracks and, listening to alarm calls and actually finding a leopard. And there is something spectacular about them. And then on the other hand, wild dog, which are completely different. You really don't track wild dogs. You get lucky. You turn left, you turn right. The dogs are on the move. If an animal is hunting at 50 k's an hour over 5 kilometers, it's not something you're going to get on the tracks. Watching them and the social interaction is phenomenal. So out of the animals that people really want to see, those are the two that really give me a kick. But going deeper into it, honey badgers and caracal and animals like that, I find a lot more interesting because they are more difficult to find and really fantastic to watch.
Then there are also the little five, where part of the names are named after the big five, like the elephant shrew because it has a long snout. There's the buffalo weaver, the leopard tortoise. The buffalo weaver is a bird, the rhino beetle, and an antlion. I remember this being told about the antlion for the first time, and I was absolutely fascinated by this. And I mean, you can see them everywhere. But I ended up sitting in a game lodge for a good 45 minutes, an hour, just watching a 50 centimeter by 50 centimeter square piece of land where basically what happens in the big world is happening on small. And there I was watching basically everything just in the microcosmos. And that was fascinating for me.
Again, it's the hook. The antlion is not that much more interesting than a lot of other things. It's very fortunate that lion is part of it and it's become part of the small five. So, as a guide, you can then use that as a segue into the small five. For me, the value of the five and having a reason to get out there, something to chase, is the incidental stuff that you come across as a result of being out there. I'm a very keen birder and I've kept a life list for Southern Africa of all the birds I've seen. And a lot of my friends are fairly critical of this whole, we call them twitchers, people who go out to find a specific bird and they're in the numbers game. But for me, the most incredible thing is I set my sights on a bird like a striped flufftail or something like that. And I'll get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and I'll go into some montane grassland and I'll be sitting there playing the call, looking, observing. And then out of nowhere, a serval comes, or a peregrine falcon will fly over, or something else. And 9 times out of 10, when you get to the point where you're looking for quite rare birds, you won't get your target, but you'll spend 4 or 5 hours out there. Whereas if you didn't have that reason to get out there, you would have glossed over that opportunity and just been lying in bed going, oh, it's a bit cold outside. There's not really much to do. So, it's that little hook. You're going out looking for something, you've done the big five, now you move into the little five, and it gives you that opportunity to start talking a little bit about ecology and a little bit about what you spoke about in the beginning, the social interactions, symbiotic relationships between a lot of these animals. And that's a big part of the evolution of people. That then becomes the intricate web that just becomes more and more fascinating. And the further you go down there, that you start to realize that you've actually got more questions and answers.
Yeah, that's exactly how it is. And then how some plants and animals also have a symbiotic relationship, not just animals to animals, but animals to plants as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I've always said that a good guide can make any game drive interesting, even when you don't see any of the big animals. But a lot of people think that without these big animals, the drive is boring. I took my partner to on a game walk a couple of years ago, and the only thing we saw on 3 hours was a giraffe. We literally saw nothing else. And I was so afraid that they would not like it and that they'd think it was a waste of time. But he told me that he found it amazing because for the first time he felt the vulnerability that humans generally don't have in this world. And that was for him a very moving moment. How do you make what I'm going to call a boring game drive more interesting? And I suppose you use some of that in your guide training as well.
We train this a lot with guides, is to stop with the radio sightings, find your own stuff. It's difficult in a lodge environment because you sit at a brunch table collectively and the other guys have seen the leopard with the kill, etc. It's very difficult for your guests to express the value that they got out of talking about a termite mound and understanding the fascination of that whole world down there. I think where some guides get it right and some don't is how you draw people into that conversation. We often see with younger guides, you know, there'll be nothing going on, they'll stop and they'll just climb up and start talking about a Ledwood tree without the whole lead in. It's how you get people into that topic and making people also understand that you're not taking away from your game drive time. You haven't stopped looking for lion and leopard, etc. Sometimes it's really important to stop and have that silent time. Getting people to think about things before you start talking about them, create that curiosity. If you create curiosity amongst your guests that they are starting to think about stuff, then they become receptive to information. It's a matter of reading the faces. Guides will often break out into this long soliloquy of the termite mound, and you can actually just see the faces of the people. You know, four sentences in, you just know it's the wrong crowd. And that's okay. You can't force people to be interested. So you keep throwing out a hook with different bait and see when you get a nibble, and try and get people into it. I always really try quite hard with the big and obvious birds and then showing them some of the relatives and seeing if I can get a little bit of a birding thing going, because that's often a really good way to get people to evolve from the whole big five and looking for wildlife into looking at other things.
I was on a game drive a couple of years back with a work colleague, and we started talking about what are some of the ugly five and what are the sexy five. What would you put on your ugly five list?
Well, the traditional ugly five is the spotted hyena.
Yeah.
Hard to argue that one.
Which is not quite fair, though. Hyenas are cute.
Which is not fair. When you first look at a hyena, you can kind of see where Disney were going with that whole sort of sly, untrustworthy kind of thing. But the moment you start following hyenas and you get into understanding how unique they are, it's just such an incredibly interesting species. And I guess this is a family show, so cut me off if I get a little
No.
too graphic here. I mean, can you imagine giving birth through like a 2.5 centimeter penis? So she has male, like basically what looks externally like male genitalia.
Yeah.
And she gives birth through the same canal that she urinates through. It
Wow.
is fascinating, the whole exposure to these male hormones while they are in the womb that basically develops these incredibly androgynous females that are super dominant over the males.
Yeah.
So, you know, once you get stuck into the fascination of hyenas, it's very hard to see them as part of the ugly five. But yeah, I can kind of see where people are coming from.
Yeah.
Of course, the vultures just get lumped in there together,
Yeah.
which is a little bit harsh. You look at a white-headed vulture, to me, it's actually quite a
Yeah.
beautiful bird. You look at a leopard-faced vulture, I kind of see
Yeah.
where you're coming from. And then marabou stork.
Look, I'm not going to let you t talk me into thinking that a marabou stork is beautiful in any way.
No, that is definitely top of the list, and I'm not going to try and justify anything with the marabou stork. Blue wildebeest looks like it was put together by a committee that were, you know, high on marijuana. And then the warthog, you know, I think Disney had a lot to do with
Yeah,
that with
Pumbaa.
Pumbaa. And a lot of people see warthogs as a lot more cute than they used to. But if you sit
Yeah.
and look at a photograph of a warthog, it seems to deserve its place. So yeah, that is the traditional ugly five. What's your opinion, Andre? Would you stick anything else in the ugly five?
I would struggle to keep the warthog there, the hyena definitely not. I'm happy with the wildebeest and the marabou being in there, but there's nothing else that I would
Yeah,
add into there.
it's tough because, you know, you develop a lot of respect for all of these animals. So to lump anything into the ugly five does become counterintuitive when you get to know the animals. But again, it's something to go out and game drive. Okay, cool. We've seen the big five. Let's see if we can tick off the ugly five. And it's just a reason to stay out that little bit longer and hope you bump into something really exciting that's going to create a once in a lifetime experience. The sexy five or beautiful five is in Botswana, we typically refer to the lilac-breasted roller, cheetah, greater kudu, which is an interesting one. I actually find the female greater kudu more beautiful than the male. You know, with those big doe eyes and those massive ears. African wild dog definitely deserves its place there, and then giraffe. But it's so open to interpretation. The moment you throw in lilac-breasted roller, what about an arena trogon, etc.? But the lilac-breasted roller is the really achievable year-round resident. It's got that beautiful electric blue when it takes off. So, you know, if it's not necessarily the most beautiful bird in Botswana or through the savanna ecosystems of southern Africa. But it's one that you can show people reliably across the
Yeah.
savanna landscapes of South Africa, Zimbabwe, Botswana, and Namibia, and all the way up into East
Yeah.
Africa. So, for that reason, it earns its place. Would I change that for a saddle-billed stork? Yes, I would.
Okay. I'm gonna have to Google that. I'm not as good with birds as you are. I love spending time with someone who is very good with birds and has a passion for it. Then I really get into it, but I need to grow on that. My list had the zebra, the blue crane, the giraffe, the fish eagle, and the white-faced Scops owl. Last weekend, and that
Ooh,
really is a
yes.
beautiful.
That's quite a bird-heavy list. I like it. I
Yeah,
like
I was also surprised again how bird-heavy it is when I read it out now.
it. Yeah, the white-faced Scops owl, I think those orange eyes are absolutely hypnotic. It's just a stunning species, and that soft
Yeah.
little dove-like call, everything about it is really just, it's such an endearing bird. I
Yeah.
actually really, I really like that as an addition.
Yeah. I like owls generally, so but that's a really beautiful one. And then just back
Yeah,
to
absolutely.
hyenas. If we came across a hyena, I think it's a den you call it, right?
Yes.
We came across a hyena den and we did what I love doing on Game Drive. We just sat there for 20 minutes and just watched the little ones running around, and that's when I learned for the first time how the whole babysitting thing works in the hyena clan. That basically the females go hunting and one of them stays at home every day to kind of run the nursery, so to speak. Have I got that right?
Yes, 100%.
I found that fascinating.
Yeah, and the same happens in wild dogs. And actually, with wild dogs, it's interesting because even if the mother of the wild dogs die, once they get to a few weeks old, the mother becomes completely irrelevant because the pack of dogs are so social. And so wild dogs start weaning very early. Very often the alpha female will allow the beta to mate. But often those pups are killed because they're not needed. But that does mean you've got a second female producing milk to be able
Okay.
to feed. Within a few weeks, the rest of the pack will be bringing back food, which is pre-chewed and swallowed. They'll be regurgitating that. In times when there's a huge amount of food, they sometimes don't kill the beta. So if the pack is looking to grow its size,
Yeah.
the beta pups will survive. With the hyenas, with the wild dogs, with all of these social animals, when you start to scratch below the surface, that's where the magic lies. I kind of feel sorry for people that come to Botswana and do a self-drive. As much as there's a lot to be said for the adventure of going through a water crossing on your own and kind of finding your way from camp to camp, what you miss out on is peeling the layers of the onion and getting to understand what's happening out there. They're two very different experiences, and I guess they shouldn't even be compared. But I think to go to any place without a guide to, open up the whole ecological interactions and the social interactions of these animals is quite sad.
Yeah, no, I'm with you 100%, Grant. It makes all the difference. If you take a rental car and you go and drive through the Kruger, but even then you would sit at a waterhole for 2 hours or 3 hours and just see what happens there in the morning and the evening. But I never want to miss out on getting all of that information from a guide who puts it all together, basically.
I guess, there is a place for self-drive, particularly if you're going to somewhere like Etosha in Namibia and you want to go
Yeah.
and sit for 4 hours at a waterhole and just be quiet and birdwatch on your own.
Yeah.
You're taking the time. I always make a big distinction between when animals approach me and they choose to expose themselves to me and how close they can come rather than me coming in on a sighting, finding
Yeah.
them and imposing my presence on them. Very often you'll end up with a change of behavior. When you really want to appreciate animals' behavior, you need to spend time there. And sometimes that's where the guided experience actually can be a little bit of a compromise because if
Yeah.
you're on a vehicle with a lot of other people and there's a lot of pressure on the guide to find the big five, then you don't actually get to sit and watch the behavior. With the first 10, 15 minutes you arrive at a sighting, it is an interruption to those animals. They all look up, they all change their
Yeah.
behavior, and then slowly they settle down. And it's only really with patient tourists and a good guide that can really explain to people the value of
Yeah.
breaking through that barrier of boredom to then appreciate what the animals are doing and then see them to start interacting with each other, getting ready to hunt. The true magic only happens once those animals sort of blank you out and you become part of the background noise.
Yeah, to practice slow tourism again is just coming to mind.
Absolutely. It's become really obvious. There's a lot of people wanting to change the pace, a lot of people wanting to get back to basics, get out on foot, get away from the plunge pools and spas. A lot of people are actually wanting to come to Africa for an experience. And if you have everything that you have at home on safari, it's not really an experience. An experience is something that takes you outside of your comfort zone, and you are doing something different and experiencing something slightly unnerving. You related it to your friends and partners, just being humbled by feeling part of the food chain. That in itself, for a lot of people, is something they don't really put their finger on, but it really makes them feel alive, because we're allowed to become so arrogant. We are so well protected in the world that we live in. That's what experiences are made of, is that feeling of being humbled, that feeling of feeling slightly insecure. Those are the things that people really remember.
Yeah, absolutely. You're a big birder. How would you get me interested in birding?
I think the trigger for me has always been not to. Birding is a process. It's allowing people to absorb in their own time and allowing people just to feel that they can actually do this. When you get to a sighting, instead of blurting out the names all the time, have a look at this, have a look at that, what are the similarities? The moment you see that it's got a conical shaped bill, it's a seed eater, we're going to the back of the book. It's in this group, and empowering people to be able to do that. Then when they get to camp, they take their binos. We've always got that period in the middle of the day where things are a little bit quiet. People sit with their binos, and suddenly they're like, oh, that's got a conical shaped bill. That's going to be at the back of the book. Instead of having to go through 900 birds of Southern Africa, suddenly you're going through 150 birds, and it's a bit doable. And then they'll go to the guide before afternoon drive and say, hey, I saw this bird. I think it was a weaver, da da da. And it's a slippery slope, Andre, because once you become a birder, you can't unbird yourself. So be careful.
No, I think what you said there now is exactly the point. Is if I look at that birding book, and like you say, it has 900 pages, like how do I even start to identify the bird that flew past and it wasn't there for very long? It's getting an understanding for which are the things that you look for to be able to start the broad classification of this is how the beak looks or this is how the feet look, so that's why it belongs to this category or something like that.
Absolutely.
I've just googled the saddle-billed stork and it really is a beautiful animal. It really is
Stunning, isn't
beautiful.
it?
Tell us about Lataka safaris. What is a mobile tented safari and what type of guests normally book this?
Interesting question. Mobile tented safaris is fairly unique to Botswana, in terms of the fact that our camps really are mobile. In East Africa, they talk about mobile safaris, but they generally follow the migration. They're in one place for between 3 to 6 months, some of them. So they're not moving all the time. The terms are a little bit fluid, but in terms of the Botswana mobile safari, the concept is that you take everything with you. We're in the semi-luxury, non-participation mobile safari, and that sounds like an absolute mouthful, but I'll get to that distinction now. But basically, we have a team that goes ahead. They'll set up camp. It's, a nice walk-in Meru-style tent, with lots of space, an ensuite shower, ensuite toilet. There's a chef that does three-course meals. It's all fully inclusive with really nice South African wines, all the booze. So basically, our guests don't do anything. And the distinction between that and the lodge safari is, firstly, it's small group travel, so our maximum group size is seven. I think the greatest selling point for the mobile safari, to me, is having the same people for the 10-day safari, because people really relax with each other. I know you did a lot of educationals or familiarization trips, as some people call them. In day one, day two of the educational, everything's a little bit stiff. You don't know what jokes you can or can't crack. You don't know people's backgrounds. Day three, day four is where the magic happens, and people really relax around each other. And the lodges, as comfortable as they are and as amazing as the cuisine and everything is, you never achieve that on those safaris. You're changing guides every 3 days, so there's that little bit of interruption in the guided experience. But from a guest point of view, today you're with the Joneses, tomorrow you're with the Smiths, you're on day nine of safari, the Smiths are on day one or two, so the guide has to go back to the whole Impala spiel. So there isn't that continuity, and Which leads me into the biggest point is having the same guide from start to finish.
Yeah.
If you really want to delve into the safari experience and understand the ecological interactions, when a guide can refer to on day nine what you saw on day two and how this ties into that, they've just got this really incredible blank canvas that over 10 days they can paint this really incredible picture. That's the way I think mobiles come into their own, the solitude of being out in a wilderness campsite with nobody else around you. There's no kitchen area, there's no generators, there's no staff area. You are literally together on this tiny little wilderness site, and when we leave, there's nothing but footprints. So, for the animals, we are a temporary interruption. So mobiles in Botswana, just as a broad overview, basically range from where you put up your own tent and help the guide cook the meals, super budget, all the way through to what we do, which is the semi-luxury. And then there are the super luxury mobiles. We at Lataka Safaris put ourselves where we are in the market is we're pretty much as comfortable as you can be, where you can still move the entire camp within a day, which means we don't have to break it up with a lodge or something else in between. So you have that continuity of every day you're with the same staff.
Okay. So that was actually one of my questions. How long are you then in a site? On a 10-day tour, you would do 3 nights, 3 nights, 3 nights. So you're actually spending time in a location as well, and then you drive or walk out from that location, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, a lot of people are really tempted when they look at an African itinerary. It's like, okay, well, we want to do Kakanika, we want to do the Panhandle, we want to do Kwai, we want to do this, we want to do that. And people jam so much in there, and they look at this itinerary, and it's really attractive because it's covering all of these aspects. But actually, you've got one afternoon activity in the Panhandle on a boat, and then the next morning you've got a full day traveling. Basically, you need to have a look at the ratio of time that you're spending traveling from one place to another and the amount of time. We're all about experiences. And I like that about the mobile because even when you're moving from site A to site B, because we don't do long trips, the moving day is part of the experience.
Sure.
You're not worried about what time do we have to be at the airstrip with packing. You don't have to worry about transfer times. You just arrive at the next place and everything happens. I really love the 3 nights in one place because my first full day in a place as a guide, I'm kind of getting my head around it. Okay, the dogs are there. I've seen
Yeah.
these leopard tracks here. I've heard the lions calling in the south. By the end of day two, I've got a really good picture. And day three is when I can do my best work as a guide. So we built our itineraries around what Brent and I experienced. We haven't spoken about Brent. Sorry, he's my brother and my business partner. We wanted to create the best possible experiences, and that's for both of us the best recipe.
I think what you said just now is so important, is that because you're together as a group and with a guide for the whole time, the fact that you can just build on what you've experienced is invaluable, because I think you just go so much deeper with the experiences and the information. If I think how many times you go to your second lodge and you're on a vehicle with people that have arrived in Africa for the first time, and then you have to start way back with the basic information again, and you never really go very far in that sense.
And I can't tell you actually, Andre, how many times I've guided a group of people, never met each other, don't know each other from Adam, and a year later I'll get a photograph of them together in the Galapagos, and the next year they're in Machu Picchu. It's deeper than just the guided thing. It's also the relationships that people develop with each other.
Yeah.
And the nice thing with mobile safaris is it does tend to select out the precious traveler, the people that want to be pampered. I call them the fashion travelers, the people that have never been to Africa and they've got to kind of go and do it. And because of what we do and how we do it, we tend to get very down to earth, real people and very much like-minded people.
Yeah, I was going to use the word real as well. I like to finish my episodes off with questions about favorites. What is your favorite spot in Botswana and why?
I guess my current favorite place would be Mabuasuhube Game Reserve. There's something about Mabuasuhube that is very special, and it is off the beaten track. What I yearn for these days is wilderness. I love to be with my family or with a group of people somewhere completely remote. I think for a lot of people these days, traveling to places where there aren't a lot of other people is it's pretty spiritual.
Absolutely. if you look at the entire animal kingdom, which is your favorite animal?
Black Mamba.
The Black Mamba? Why?
Yeah. Poetry in motion. I don't know. There's something, you watch a large mamba moving through the bush, you know, it raises the front quarter above the ground and it just sails through the grass and everything just stands in awe of watching this mamba move through the wilderness. I've always loved snakes. I don't know. It's just a genetic impairment that I was born with. But there is no snake like a black mamba. You know, even for myself who is not afraid of snakes, I see a black mamba and the hairs on the back of your neck raise a little bit. And there's just this visceral sense of deep, deep, profound respect.
How long is a black mamba on average?
An average good-sized black mamba is 3 meters. Anything over 4 meters is considered exceptional.
What words would you have to someone who is thinking of coming to Africa for the first time to get them interested in more than just the big five?
I think my advice to people would be don't rush past the tranquility. Take time for the tranquil moments. Take time to listen. It's so often those times when I'm on a drive and I just switch off, you're listening, you're in tune with what is happening. Very often that's when you'll hear a reed buck alarming at a leopard, and had the engine been running, you would have missed the sighting. So don't be in that mindset where you need to chase around. Open yourself up and make the distinction between a sighting and an experience, because they're two very different things. Yeah. You know, people will tick a leopard off their list because a leopard darted across the road and they, we saw a leopard. But actually, a leopard experience is where you sit with a leopard for an hour and you watch licking the cubs or grooming herself and getting ready, you know, starting a hunt. There's a massive difference between seeing and experiencing, and rather than chasing sighting after sighting.
Yeah, that's very, very good advice. That actually reminds me of when we sat watching a leopard who had an impala up in a tree and seeing the whole interaction when parts of the impala fell on the ground, and that the interaction between the hyenas that came and the leopard in the tree, and you could see the disappointment in the leopard's face almost at the fact that he lost some part of the impala to the hyenas. So yeah, I think you're right to not chase past the tranquility. I like that. Thank you, Grant. This was amazing. Thank you so, so much for this conversation today.
Andre, thank you very much for having me on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, old friend. Really appreciated the opportunity to share a few insights and be on the show with you. And hopefully we see you in Botswana sometime soon.
What animals would you put on your list of the ugly five and the sexy five? I'd love to hear from you. Today we spoke about various animals and birds and about guiding with guests. We also learned about mobile tented safaris, and we have the first snake on the list of guests' favorite animals. I hope that Grant and I could inspire you to want to learn about all the different animals you can see and hear when you go on safari, and not just the big five. Being in the bush on safari is so beautiful and humbling. There really is a lot to see and experience. Send me your questions and comments by email to podcast@africawithandre, and see you next time.